Struggle as a baroquely unclassifiable artist whose songs fall between classical art song and indie pop. His new CD, produced by New Amsterdam Records, is Other People's Love Songs. All the songs were commissioned as gifts from one person to another. Darkle did interviews to understand the nature of their relationship and used the information to compose the lyrics and the melody. Here's My Voice Is In Your Head, commissioned by Teresa for her twin sister, Katie.
I know sometimes my voice is in your head, telling you things you might rather leave unsaid. It's just that you're so much fun to talk to. It's just that I miss you after I had my appendectomy. Sat down next to me, and we laughed at the compression stockings that kept my blood from clotting. If I had been in Costa Rica when you fell down that 30-foot well, could have lightened your mood while you were being rescued.
Our very own baby Jessica.
I will stop listening to so much NPR if you'll worship Michael Jackson from afar. And I'll stop being such a bore if you'll take me out on the dance floor.
We invited Corey Dargle to join us today on Radio Times. We'll talk about the process of putting this CD together and some of his other work. His previous CD is Less Famous Than You. He also has a music theater piece called Removable Parts, and it's based on stories of voluntary amputation. Corey Dargle, thanks for coming down from New York and joining us today on Radio Times.
It's great to be here, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So how did this idea first start, the idea of writing love songs for other people?
Well, I had been talking with some of my friends and colleagues who are also musicians, and you know, one of the problems of being a creative artist is that you have to think about your audience and how you're going to promote yourself and market yourself to the audience, and sometimes you have to think about that without really knowing what it is you're going to be making in the next few years. So we had a lot of discussions about what can we do to widen our audience and get a larger audience, and I thought, I mean, I'm sort of a contrarian, and so my response to that was, I want to write something that's for an audience of two people. I want to write a song that...
Sounds like a great business decision, too, right?
that nobody, you know, this is not a song where I'm saying, I want the song to appeal to a broad range of people. This is a song for a specific pair of people. And, of course, it naturally followed that a love song would be an appropriate type of song to write for those people. So I started advertising only on my website and saying that, you know, if you're a fan of my music and you'd like to have your own custom-made love song, email me and let me know. And that's how it started.
Well, I love the idea of a contrarian writing love songs.
Well, but, you know, I'm a romantic at heart. It's just that I'm sort of sometimes ashamed of that.
Well, this song that we heard, and this is a song from one twin sister to another, mm-hmm. My Voice Is In Your Head, and of course we had to pick it because of this reference to NPR.
Right.
One of them saying to the other, you know, I'll stop listening to so much NPR if you, you know, worship Jackson, Michael Jackson from afar.
Right. Katie is the twin sister who the song is for, and Teresa is the one who commissioned it, and I interviewed Teresa, and one of the things that she said was that Katie makes fun of her because she listens to NPR, whereas Katie is totally up on all the hip indie rock mm-hmm. bands, and who's, you know, Katie's got the playlist that she sends to Teresa, and Teresa's got the podcasts, the hour-long intellectual discussions on podcasts that she sends to Katie.
Have you learned something about love, having, you know, interviewed couples, whether it's sisters or husbands and wives or, you know, boyfriends and boyfriends? Have you learned mm-hmm. something about love?
Wow. I played an early version of this album a few months ago to a friend of mine who's a composer and a sort of mentor to me. Conrad Cummings is his name. And his response was, this album is, what I like about this album is that you're talking about love, you're framing love in a way that makes it almost mundane, almost like this is an everyday occurrence. And yes, it's special for, you know, these particular couples who are doing it at this particular time, but it's also sort of ordinary. And so I kind of like that idea of thinking about love and intimacy not as a profound and paralyzing emotion, but as something that we sort of grow into, and we sort of, it becomes, I don't want to say routine, but kind of we notice the little things about each other.
And I noticed that in the songs, that they really were about these small moments that people shared together.
Exactly.
Or just memories that they might have that are obviously just uniquely their own. No one else can have those kinds of memories.
Yeah, and it's like if you're in a relationship with someone and you have that moment where you say, what did you think of me when you first met me? Right. You know, those kind of moments.
What were the kinds of questions that you asked people? Do you have standard questions, or does it sort of vary from couple to couple?
I have standard questions that I start out with, and then it usually goes from there. You know, people will start telling me what they want to tell me. But my boilerplate questions are things like, how did you meet? What's the most exciting thing you've ever done together? How have you changed each other over the years? Things like that.
Well, I want to play another a section from another song, and this is Had I Jumped from Anne, for Anne from Kurt. And it's the liner notes say, Kurt and Anne are both writers. They had similar upbringings, grew up in a relatively close Midwestern towns, but they didn't meet until both of them had moved to New York City. Anything you want our listeners to listen for?
I think that sums it up.
Let's listen. This is Had I Jumped.
My first blind date, and also my last. A boy and a girl from almost parallel states. A boy and a girl with almost parallel pasts. In fact, had I jumped into the Missouri River Omaha when I was 17, and had it carried me down to Kansas City, I bet you would have rescued me. Before we started going gray, before there was Lucy, before there was Kate, before our wedding.
That's a song called Had I Jumped from Other People's Love Songs. Corey Dargle, our guest today on Radio Times. There's that refrain, had I jumped into the Missouri River and have floated downstream, you would have, I believe you would have rescued me.
Mm-hmm.
That was something that one of them said directly to you?
No, it wasn't actually.
Oh,
it was something that I interviewed Kurt for this song, and Kurt told me that he and his wife lived close by geographically, and they were both on, you know, near the Missouri River. So Kurt is upstream, and I thought, well, you know, wouldn't it be nice to think back and, you know, to imagine that if when he was a teenager, if he had been, you know, had jumped into the river and then carried downstream by the river, and his wife to be
would have rescued him
right there.
What are those instruments we hear? There's a lot going on in the background behind your voice.
The album is made with samplers and synthesizers. Everything is generated electronically except for my voice. So you're hearing drum machines, and you're hearing sampled guitar, acoustic guitar plucks, and everything is manipulated 10 or 12 times over.
Wow.
By the computer. I really use the recording and mixing studio as another instrument. But in concert performances, in the live performances of these songs, I've arranged the songs for chamber ensemble, for classical chamber ensemble, and the only thing that remains of the electronics in the concert performances are the drum machines. So you hear the drum track.
And we're coming up on our first break here, but do you start with your voice? Is that where you begin and then lay all these other tracks around it, or do you build the tracks and then layer on your voice?
I start with the accompaniment tracks, actually, and I tend to work on four or five different accompaniment tracks at the same time and listen to them obsessively without knowing what the melody or lyrics will be for those tracks. And then as I'm, one day I'll have an insight as to what the melody and lyric should be. And that's how I usually work. Start with the tracks.
And do you work by yourself? I mean, it's you and the instruments?
It's all me, just by myself. Yeah, very lonely job.
Is it?
It is lonely not to be able to, when I feel like I've come up with something, not to be able to immediately play it for someone and say, look what I came up with today, isn't this great? I do miss that kind of bouncing off people. Bouncing off ideas.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation, play some more music with our guest and by our guest, Corey Dargle. He does have a new CD produced by New Amsterdam Records. In fact, it opens next week, or I guess makes its debut next week. And he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios to play some selections from that new CD. And we're also going to play some more music after this very short break. In fact, we have another piece of music that we want to play, and this is called All Other Sounds. I'm Marty Moscoane. If you want to give us a call here, 1-888-477-9499.
As she was picking out her wedding gown, this only child from Youngstown felt a little less like the sad clown she once was. She's getting over her introversion. She's gonna stop singing about herself in the third person. I'm in love with you. I'm in love with you. I'm in love. No harmonic progression is lasting an impression as looking into your brown eyes. All other saxophone solos are woefully lacking in mojo. Those other guys can't really improvise. No one else swings the way you swing, the way you vibrate my heartstrings. All other sounds are just pretty lies.
A proud supporter of WHYY, BNY Mellon Wealth Management is dedicated to helping financially successful individuals and families protect and grow their wealth. Details at BNYMellonWealthManagement.com.
A regular meeting of the WHYY Board Executive Committee is scheduled for Tuesday, October 21st at 8 a.m. at WHYY 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia. For more information, call Diane Chenault at 215-351-2063.
These are challenging times when news and information is vitally important. Where do you go to get in-depth information, unbiased information? WHYY and NPR. I'm Marty Moscoane, and this is the fourth day of the membership drive here at WHYY. We need your pledge of support. 91 FM WHYY depends on listeners just like you for money to pay for the programs that you enjoy, whether it's Radio Times or Fresh Air, All Things Considered, or Morning Edition. $50 makes you a basic member here at 91 FM. Call 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY or pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks.
The Economist supports WHYY. Every week, The Economist covers issues that matter around the world and the connections between them. The Economist, on newsstands, in bookstores, and online at economist.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And if you're just joining us, Corey Dargle is our guest today on Radio Times. He's a musician, a composer, an actor, a dancer. And he's got a new CD, I guess we call them now, our new album out, Other People's Love Songs. It's based on commissions from individuals to write custom-made love songs for their significant other. This is his second album. This new album, Other People's Love Songs, actually is I guess, opening or debuting next week. And his first album called Less Famous Than You, and he also has this musical theater piece about voluntary amputation called Removable Parts. That's actually going to be performed at Pittsburgh's Warhol Theater on November 21st. And this new CD, Other People's Love Songs, available next Tuesday, October 28th. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Do you think of yourself as a composer first and foremost, a singer first and foremost? How do you think of yourself as a artist?
I think of myself as a composer, a songwriter. That's how I was trained. I was trained at Oberlin Conservatory as a music composer, music composition major. And that's where most of the support for my work has come from. But obviously I have much fondness for the immediacy and the sound world of popular music.
Sure.
So I try to embrace both of those worlds.
You grew up in Texas, small towns in Texas?
Mm-hmm. I was born in McAllen, Texas, in the Rio Grande Valley, the southern tip of the state.
And then actually grew up in another small town as well after that, right?
Well, yes, I grew up in Donna, Texas, which is a neighboring town of McAllen. But McAllen is where the hospital is, where they can give birth to babies.
And what kind of towns were these for a kid growing up?
Well, they're right on the border of Mexico, so there's a heavy Hispanic population. It's very Catholic. And there's... I would say it's actually kind of like a huge suburban area with no metropolitan center. So if you can imagine a lot of box stores, chains, there's not a lot of idiosyncratic personality in these towns. I think there are individual idiosyncratic people there.
I'm sure.
But the culture is kind of, it's hard to pin down what is the culture here? What does this local culture mean? So I never could figure that out when I was growing up.
Did you fit in at all in these towns?
No.
No.
I don't want to talk about it.
I mean, I think many people can relate to not fitting into the towns where they grew up, because I'm thinking of these little towns and then Oberlin and now Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, did you want to get out of these towns as quickly as you could as a kid growing up?
Well, there was not a lot of... I mean, I knew that I wanted to be... a creative musician when I was there and growing up in Donna, Texas. But there wasn't anywhere for me really to express that or to realize that potential for myself. And I knew that. And I knew that there were other places where I could work with musicians, where people would be interested in the kind of music that I would write. And there just wasn't that. I didn't have access to that in the small town that I grew up in. So I had always been looking for that opportunity, and that's what led me to go to music school and then to move to New York City.
But what music did you grow? I mean, as you listened to your radio down there in mm-hmm. Texas, what music did you listen to?
Oh, I was such a square. I listened to a lot of Christian rock music. I was a church-going kid, and so a lot of my musical exposure and musical training was in church.
Did you sing in the choir?
I did sing in the choir. In fact, I wrote a few pieces for the youth choir in the church. And then when I got around to listening to popular music, I really was very far behind the times. I was listening to Billy Joel and Elton John and things like that. Fortunately, good songwriters, but I was not ahead of the curve by any means.
Yeah, this seems like a bit of a leap from Elton John to what you're doing now.
Yes, I would say so.
I'm curious about the songs you wrote for your church choir. What were they about? Were they strictly sort of religious, spiritual songs?
Yeah, it's hard to remember now. I think I took pre-existing hymns and made variations or arrangements of those or something. I really don't remember.
Did you come from a musical family?
My mom is a pianist, and my dad played in a band called The Notables.
The Notables?
The Notables.
What kind of band?
It was a cover band mostly. They would do jazz standards, and they would play in retirement homes and things like that. So, and my mom is a pianist, still is a pianist at the church that I grew that I went to when I was growing up.
So a lot of music just surrounding you as a kid.
Yeah, music, going, and I liked to sing when I was a toddler. So. I think I was destined for this.
Well, I like your voice very much. There's a kind of clarity to your voice. But I did say, as I was going onto your website and looking at information about you, there's a picture of you smoking a cigarette. And I thought, gosh, your voice doesn't sound like someone who smokes. You know what I mean?
I smoke a cigarette in the musical theater piece, Removable Parts. So that's... All of those photos on my website are from that show, and so that's why you see me smoking a cigarette. It's really for, there's a song in Removable Parts where the stage picture has to look like a lounge act, a kind of, you know, sultry lounge act. So the cigarette helps with that.
But you do smoke. I'm not accusing you of anything here. There's nothing illegal about smoking, but you do smoke, yes?
Yeah, occasionally, yeah.
And does it affect your voice?
Not yet. We'll see.
Talk to us about this this theater piece, and it's called Removable Parts, and it is based on what stories of voluntary amputation. These are people that actually choose at least to consider removing a body part, and perhaps some have even gone so far as to removing a body part. But what got you interested in that?
Well, I had been wanting to work with a pianist named Kathleen Supovi, and she and I had been working together to try and find a way to create a piece together. And when we finally did get the funding to do that, I asked her what she wanted the piece to be about, and she said amputation. She gave me this these articles to read about involuntary amputation, and I've always been interested in extreme behavior. And so I did a little research on amputation, and I found out about this phenomenon, which is where people have a strong desire to have a particular limb removed because they feel that it is not a part of them. Some people have used the metaphor of transgendered people feeling that they're trapped in the wrong body to compare that to these people who wish to have a limb amputated. So the Removable Parts takes that theme of wishing to have a limb amputated and relates it to disconnection and love songs and the idea of empathy, being able to relate to someone else, even if that person's behavior seems at first to be over the top.
Is that something you can relate to? I mean, I think you probably ask most people if they're attractive or if there's something they'd like to change about their body. And I would imagine that most people would come up with something that they'd like to change. But this idea, I mean, it is taking it a step further, if not actually removing the body part, but certainly thinking about one's body in those really graphic terms.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to think about who, like, where is that line drawn?
Right.
Because we do all, I think, wish to change our bodies in some way. And we go through processes of change, like plastic surgery, even working out at the gym, getting a tattoo, getting a tongue piercing.
Botox.
Botox. But there is, but I think the notion of amputating a healthy limb is so grotesque to people that they can't imagine allowing someone to modify their body that way just because they want to.
But there are people who do this, yes?
Well, it's not really possible because surgeons won't amputate a healthy limb. So some people have gone to extraordinary lengths to injure themselves on purpose so that they can have the limb amputated after that injury. And it usually doesn't work. They end up being mutilated, and it's worse than it was before because they haven't had an amputation and now they've injured themselves and have become mutilated on top of being uncomfortable with the limb to begin with.
And this is a condition called body integrity identity disorder.
Yeah.
In the most sort of, you know, scientific terms.
Right. And the funny thing about BIID is that the definition of it is basically that your image of yourself in your mind and what you see in the mirror don't match up. And I read that and I was like, well, now
isn't that true for everybody,
yeah,
right?
I feel that way. I have a little bit of a cognitive dissonance when I look at myself in the mirror. I think a lot of people probably do. And so Removable Parts was a way for me to take this extreme behavior and try to, over the course of the show, make it seem more and more understandable and less abnormal as the show goes on.
And I'd like to play actually a song from this. This is Hooked for Life. And just for our listeners to understand this musical theater piece, in a sense, they're narratives of from different individuals as they talk about their bodies and think about their bodies and what they might actually want to remove.
Right. These are case studies. These songs are case studies of people who suffer from this condition.
And where did you get these stories or these case studies?
Oh, all over the place. It's difficult actually to find studies of this phenomenon because there are so few people who are willing to come out on the record and say that they have this desire. But you can find out some things about it in medical journals and on the internet, obviously. And
right.
So all the stories in this show have been compiled from various different sources, most of which are over the internet.
Let's listen. This is Hooked for Life.
These stupid arms, they hold on to people like you. Though they mean no harm, they can't seem to let go. And they wave goodbye when they mean hello. Each arm just below the shoulder, I'll be a double amputee. Like a wounded soldier, well, people see what they want to see. I'll go with metal hook prosthetics, I might as well, because I damage everything I hold on to. You'll feel obliged to be sympathetic, you'll let me hold you, even though you won't want to. Cause you'll be hooked for life, I'll wrap my hooks around you. Don't worry, they're duller than butter knives, and your skin's too thick to cut into.
And that's Hooked for Life from Corey Dargle's musical theater piece called Removable Parts. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What's so interesting is you could look at some of these lyrics and just find them sort of laugh out loud funny. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, just bizarrely funny. But your delivery is straightforward, almost like a deadpan delivery that you have.
Yeah, I like the idea of taking extremely bizarre subjects and treating them with immense earnestness. Because, you know, it's a way of, and humor is a way of drawing people in. It's a way to get people to let down their defenses. So when you can bring people together with laughter,
right,
then I think they're more willing to let you raise more serious aspects of the topics that you're exploring.
And do you find, having performed this, that people do laugh, or they don't know how to react exactly, or their jaw, you know, they're sort of agape as they listen to you sing these songs?
It's really difficult to read the audience when I'm performing this show, and I've learned not to try, because it can be upsetting. But I think people do laugh, and people do have the opposite reaction, where they're just sort of mortified. And so depending on where I'm looking in the audience when I'm performing, I may see one or the other reaction. But I think the most honest reaction that I got from a stranger who I met after one of the performances, she came up to me and she said, "I really, really loved this piece, but I don't think I should have." And I thought that was the most genuine response that I had gotten.
Well, it's interesting that you don't look at the audience because you don't want to either throw you off or think to yourself, gosh, they're not getting it, or mm-hmm. somehow get self-conscious about your performance if you're not getting the response you're looking for.
Well, I mean, it's funny because I like to put myself in a vulnerable position as a performer. I feel like that's compelling for an audience member to see, to know that you are giving something of yourself to the audience, that you're not just going through
world.
The routine of doing something and people happen to be there, but that you have an intimacy with your audience. So for me, creating that intimacy or the vulnerability that I have as a performer is an important part of creating that connection between me and the audience.
And are there things you do to prepare yourself for that, or just get into that space, so to speak?
Well, I think I just, I've always had a bit of a stage fright problem. And so it's just a matter, I think, of me embracing that and saying, in a way, it's good that I have this stage fright. I'm going to just show that. I'm going to show people that I have that. And I think it works, strangely.
Well, I would imagine that'd be difficult starting off feeling a sense of stage fright. I mean, that could keep most performers off the stage.
Right.
But it drew you to the stage in a way?
I think I learned to accept it because I would literally get physically ill before I would perform. And I realized that there was nothing that I could do to get over that stage fright. So I either had to stop performing or I had to learn to accept it and embrace it somehow. And I, to be honest with you, I don't remember how that transition happened, but now I don't get sick before I perform. I don't get as nervous, but my nerves are something that I'm okay with now. So
you can maybe talk to yourself, say, okay, here it goes again.
Exactly.
Which is helpful, right? Well, I'll tell you what, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Corey Dargle is our guest today on the show. He's a composer, a singer, he's an actor and a dancer, and he's got a new collection of songs called Other People's Love Songs. In fact, we are playing selections from that new CD. And I do want to open up the lines to our listeners if you have any questions or comments, and that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's listen to another selection, and this is something called I Don't Remember, and this is from Corey Dargle's new collection of songs called Other People's Love Songs. Let's listen.
Some things are most easily repaired by learning to forgive and forget, like that final drag we shared on our very last cigarette, like that under-rehearsed and under-prepared performance of Janacek's string quartet. I may not be the most flamboyant man on Eastern Avenue, and you may not be the most litigious man at FBT, but every day we walk a few more miles in each other's shoes, and we're becoming more like each other than the men we used to be. You may not be the most activist in all Ohio, and I may not be the most religious man from Tennessee, but imagine what a perfect child we could raise in our humble home.
And that's a song called The Men We Used to Be. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Freelancers Union, an 85,000 member nonprofit organization dedicated to supporting independent workers in a variety of industries. More at freelancersunion.org.
Act 2 Playhouse in Ambler, Pennsylvania supports WHYY and presents the regional premiere of Magnetic North. A young husband meets a woman from his past during a period of crisis in his marriage. Flirtation? Betrayal? A fine line. Directed by Act Two producing artistic director Bud Martin, Magnetic North is on stage October 21st through November 16th. Tickets and information at act2.org. That's act2.org.
It's the fourth day of the membership drive here at WHYY, and we need your pledge of support. I'm Marty Moscone. 91 FM WHYY depends on listeners just like you for money to pay for the programs that you enjoy, like Radio Times, Fresh Air, All Things Considered, and Morning Edition. $50 makes you a basic subscriber. Make a call at 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at whyy.org. Make that pledge. Thanks.
Supporting WHYY, Glenn Mead, an independent investment and wealth management firm for individuals, families, and institutions seeking thoughtful advice, generation after generation. Details are available from Jeff Rogers at 302-661-4554.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Mosco, and Corey Dargle is our guest today on the show. He's a Brooklyn-based conservatory-trained composer. His new album is Other People's Love Songs, and as we have been talking about during this hour, it's based on commissions from individuals to write custom-made love songs for their significant other. This is Corey Dargle's second album, his first album called Less Famous Than You, and we were also playing a musical selection from his musical theater piece called Removable Parts. 1-888-477-9499. In fact, Removable Parts will be performed at Pittsburgh's Warhol Theater. That's on November 21st. And this new CD will be available next week on Tuesday, October 28th. Talk a little bit about the kind of training that you got at Oberlin. And as you described, you know, growing up in this Texas town where you felt like you didn't exactly fit in, how did you end up at Oberlin?
Well, Oberlin was musically it was a very high quality place to be, and so I feel like I was lucky to get in there. But I didn't go directly from home to Oberlin. First, I went to an arts boarding high school called Interlochen Arts Academy in Michigan.
Oh wow!
And then after that, I went to the University of Cincinnati's College Conservatory of Music because my teacher, my music composition teacher at Interlochen, the high school, had studied at Cincinnati, and she suggested that I go there. Cincinnati was a bit of a rough time for me because the town I thought was pretty conservative. It was hard to find things that really appealed to me there, and the conservatory was part of a large university of 40,000 students or so. So, and it was mostly geared toward graduate students. So I ended up feeling a little bit overwhelmed by my environment, which then led me to look at Oberlin Conservatory, which is, as you probably know, a part of a small liberal arts college in rural Ohio. And I thought, well, that sounds like a better place to be. So I went there. And I guess
Because it was rural in a way? I mean, it was small.
It was small.
You could be known. You felt like you could, know people.
I felt more comfortable in a smaller environment, I think. Yeah. Yeah.
And Oberlin, you went there to learn composing, right?
Right.
The idea of doing things like this, or is this something that you have surprisingly moved your way towards?
It's funny. At Oberlin, I was very much opposed to any sort of electronic music. I wanted everything to be acoustic and real, you know, in quotes. And I studied, the kind of music composition that interested me was very sort of off the wall, experimental, even conceptual sometimes pieces. And so I think what one of my teachers convinced me eventually to do was to go back to what I wanted to do from the start, which was to write songs. And he was insightful enough, I think, to recognize that despite my contrarian nature and my trying to figure out all these different possibilities and all these different things, that how far could I push the envelope in this direction, I think he was insightful enough to tell me, but Corey, if what you really want to do is write love songs, you should write love songs.
And that was a revelation.
Yeah, yeah, and it allowed me to write these songs with all of those experiences in my head, you know, all of that conservatory training gurgling around in my brain, so that I think that affects the intricacy of the songs that I'm making as well.
And do you also enjoy the sort of traditional love songs that we think of? I mean, those great songs that of the 20th century.
Like what?
Well, I mean, they're just wonderful composers that early on in the 20th century that just wrote the very traditional love songs and great lyrics and stammering around here because I can't pull up a name, but the ones we would think of as love songs.
Yeah, there's like All of Me, for example,
sure.
or Moon River.
Sure.
And yeah, I mean, there's, yeah, I mean, I like any song that's well written. And I think, you know, love's, like I said before, I think I'm a romantic at heart, but I tend to be ashamed to admit that to people or to show it too much. So although I do have a sentimental side, I also appreciate songs that come at love sideways and that treat it a little bit more obtusely.
There are, and you had explained earlier to us about some of the instrumentation that you use, and I mean, there are times when I feel like I'm hearing a toy piano, and I'm just interested in the kinds of sounds that you're looking for as you construct some of these songs.
Sure. I'm looking for things that are not immediately recognizable, or if I'm using a sound that's recognizable, like the toy piano, for example, I might alter it in the recording studio. I might use post-production techniques to alter it, so adding some kind of delay or reverb effect or a filter on the piano that makes it sound like something slightly electronic. So I guess I'm trying to really get into the sound itself so that I can alter each component. It's almost like looking at sound in a microscope and then sort of using a scalpel to adjust every little thing so that I can manipulate it that way.
I mean, it sounds like a very exacting kind of work that you do to find that kind of that right kind of sound.
It is, but it's also playful. Because it's not like I'm going to drive myself crazy if I don't get exactly the right thing that I'm looking for. It's part of the process for me is discovering what happens if I move this over here, what happens if I move this over here, what happens if I alter this parameter, and then you sort of discover things by accident, which oftentimes can be happy accidents.
And I'm just also curious about and something that I had read about you, that you're part of what some have described as the art song writer movement.
Mm-hmm.
What is that, and is there a movement, and what's the movement about?
Well, that was something that I started talking about, art songwriter being one whole word. People who like me have grown up with popular music in their ears all the time, and who have gone to conservatory to train as composers and to learn how to write music in that way, notated music. And we come out of that process, I think there is a group of composers who have come out of that wanting to write songs that they themselves sing and write the lyrics and the music and sing them. So rather than call us singer-songwriters or composers, I thought, well, why not join the two and call us art songwriters? Like, art song is actually a term that's used to talk about songs that a soprano or a classical singer would sing in a recital with a piano. So art song is that kind of classically trained singer singing a setting of poems by composers.
So it has an interesting history included. I mean, that harkens back to an interesting musical singing history.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, you know what? I'd love to play actually another song, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about this. This is actually from your first album or your first CD, and it's called I Don't Remember.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the making of this particular song.
Sure. This is a song that I wrote for a friend of mine whose mother was going through Alzheimer's. And it was a model, I think, for other people's love songs, my new album, because it was in a sense a custom-made song for this friend of mine, for her mother, and she played it for her mother, and her mother really enjoyed it. So I think that's all I need to say about it, and I think you'll hear from the lyrics what I'm talking about.
Well, let's listen, and then we'll talk some more.
Sometimes I pick up the phone and try to think of your number, but I never write things down, and I'm not getting any younger. I may
have been in love at some point, but I don't remember. I lose my memory faster than I lose my temper. If I've forgotten your name or the sound of your voice, it's not that I'm a bad person. I was never good with faces. Everyone looks the same, and there's too much noise. And I've got an aversion to loud and crowded places. I used to.
And that's a song called I Don't Remember from Corey Dargle's first CD called Less Famous Than You. And as we were talking while we were listening to that music, what was so interesting to me is that oftentimes people with either Alzheimer's or some form of dementia, to the outside world, they look disoriented. I mean, things they're doing don't make sense. Mm-hmm. But this song sort of takes us inside their head. There's a certain kind of logic to what's going on. Those memories are a little more pristine inside the head, whereas on the outside, they look confused.
Sure. Well, I mean, one of the themes that I come back to constantly is the notion of empathy. And, you know, it's just like in Removable Parts, for example. People do things that to someone else might seem absurd or at the very least kind of strange. But then the more you're able to put yourself in their shoes and sort of, you know, think what they might be thinking and experience the world as they might be experiencing it, then you can relate to what they're doing more than you might think you could originally. So,
do you see your songs as sort of breaking down some of those barriers? I mean, because there is so much sort of prejudice and judgment of people.
Well, but isn't that the kind of thing that makes love so compelling that I could be wrong about this, but I wonder if the definition of love might have something to do with wanting to understand someone so completely and know someone so fully that you can feel what it's like to be experiencing the world as they're experiencing it. And of course, we can never do that. We can never experience another person's consciousness. So it makes love something that we're always striving for, but that we will never achieve. And so I sometimes wondered as I was writing this album if that was the sort of crux of it all.
Well, and I think empathy is the word to use to describe that.
Mm-hmm.
That you can understand someone so well that you can imagine being them in a sense.
Right, right.
Let me add one more thing before we have to say goodbye, because you did co-found an experimental theater, I guess in Brooklyn or New York, called the Laboratory Theater. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and how performance and acting helps you as a singer, composer.
I think the nice thing about that is that you can we have different things that we're thinking about as a theater company, as a performance group. Constantly thinking about different layers of what am I doing movement-wise? How does this look to the audience visually? What am I supposed to be saying or singing text-wise? And I think the great thing about that is that it lets you think about performance on all those different levels. And so when I'm performing these songs, I can still think about, well, what is the audience seeing as I'm singing this, and what does that mean? And what am I doing with my body? Am I moving in some way? Should I come up with some choreography that is always set when I sing this song? You know. So I think that performing with the Laboratory Theater has been helpful in that way.
Well, also, I know I can see your voice is running out of gas here, and we're almost out of time. But so much of your songs are about a character. I mean, they're about a person. It isn't talking about something over there. You really are this person singing this song.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's part of the sort of acting that you were just talking about.
Sure, sure, and it's also part of me that I like songs that are sort of confessional in that way. But I also get nervous revealing too much about myself. So adopting a character so that maybe there's a part of me in that character, but it's not really me, or talking about another person, as in other people's love songs, it allows me to be more, in a way, more sincere than I would otherwise be if I was talking about myself only.
That's interesting. Well, on that note, I'm going to thank you very much, Corey Dargle, for joining us today on Radio Times. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And his new CD, his new album, is called Other People's Love Songs, based on commissions from individuals to write custom-made love songs for their significant other. It's his second album, and it's going to have its opening or its availability next Tuesday, October 28th. And also his musical theater piece about voluntary amputation, removable parts being performed at Pittsburgh's Warhol Theater on November 21st.
And thank you, Marty. I am Susan Greenbaum here with Alan Too to remind you that this is our October membership drive, hoping you will take a moment to give us a call at 1-888-345-9499. And if you call, you can talk with the kind folks from Penn Stress Management who volunteered their time to come down and do a good community thing help answer our phones.
That's one of the fun things about public radio. I mean, it when we do these drives, I mean, it really is this literal coming together of the community.
It's true. No, we see so many people coming in here in the studio to answer the phones. It really is the spirit of public broadcasting.
And the listeners get a call in, and they tell us how things are going, and hopefully they're going to make a pledge. If you really do like Radio Times, we are asking you to call up right now, because we're just taking a few minutes out of our program this morning to ask for your support. So that's one of the things that Radio Times does, is they make sure that the amount of programming is pushed to the maximum.
Right.
So the amount of pitching is kept down to a minimum. Asking you to call us right now at 1-888-345-9499. And again, we've had volunteers from Penn Stress Management. They've been here since 10 o'clock. They've been answering phones during
Radio
Times.
Maybe they had to walk around our building a little bit.
What do you mean?
Well, the folks from Penn Stress Management. You know, we've got stressful jobs.
Right, exactly. So asking you to make that call. Also, you can pledge online at whyy.org. Our new blog. A lot of good blogs there, whyy.org, but make sure you make a pledge.
And again, that number is 1-888-345-9499, whyy.org. Alan, that was a very pleasant hour.